Ventura?
May it please the court. The reason we require expert testimony when a topic is technical and complex is not just so that the jury will understand it, but that we have assurances of reliability. A trial court properly performs its gatekeeping role when it ensures that an expert witness is qualified, the witness has expertise, and can be cross-examined on limitations of that expertise. That didn't happen in this case. Here, Detective Lehman was not qualified as an expert and could not be qualified as an expert because he lacked the training and experience, but he nonetheless provided testimony that should only come from an expert if it comes in at all. Lehman testified that my client's phone made 16 calls that connected to 10 cell sites. He testified about the proximity of those calls to some location that was important to the state's case. The undeniable implication was that my client's phone, and therefore my client, was at that location at that time. That is the essence of historical cell site analysis, and it must come from an expert witness. Because Lehman's testimony was at the center of the state's case against my client, the appellate division correctly vacated the convictions. The state argues that Lehman's testimony was just fact testimony. It was the location of a cell site to which defendant's phone connected at a particular time, and the jury was free to accept it or reject it as it saw fit. There are three major problems with this argument. The first is that the location of a cell site is irrelevant to this case unless it is being offered to reach a conclusion about the location of a phone. But if that's what it's being used for, an expert is needed to explain the actual coverage area of the cell site sector. Otherwise, the jury would be forced to speculate. If the expert couldn't provide the actual coverage area, his opinion would need to be based on the attributes of the cell site and neighboring cell sites to which the phone did not connect. He'd need to take account of man-made features, natural topography, the strength and height of antennas, load balancing, significant weather events, and the phone itself. None of that happened here. The second reason is that this testimony was not offered as basic fact testimony. Lehman repeatedly testified about the tower's proximity to significant locations. The state argued in summation that defendant's phone was, quote, in close proximity to the towers, quote, in all points of time. The state also argued that the records show, quote, clearly that defendant was in the car with the victim, close quote, in Bridgeton. The state elicited testimony purporting to show the defendant's path of travel as it accessed towers, the same as the victim's path of travel based on surveillance video. So this was only fact testimony in some sort of imaginary vacuum, not the way this case was actually tried. And to answer Justice Pierre-Louis' question, some facts must come from an expert. This court wouldn't allow a DNA clerk from a DNA laboratory to come in and say, here's an electropherogram. I don't know much about DNA, but here's some peaks and valleys, and that's all I can tell you. And then argue in summation, would not allow the state to argue in summation. See, look, the DNA links the defendant to the crime. Look at those peaks. We can kind of figure out that if a peak is really high here, that means there's a lot of DNA, right? And it looks like it must be his DNA. So it's the idea that there's certain facts that must come from an expert witness, or they're facts that don't really have any relevance to the case. Justice Wehner Apler, you had a question about whether there was an objection to the state's argument in summation, and there was a fairly detailed objection and timer. The prosecutor said, I have an objection that I want to, and I want to be heard regarding her closing.
Give us this a citation, I'm sorry.
Yes, Your Honor. 11T, so July 1st, 2021, page 111, beginning at line 8. The defense counsel says, Your Honor, I'm going to object to parts of Ms. Snock's closing regarding cell phone evidence, the cell towers. The court has ruled that the location of the towers cannot be used as evidence of the location of any particular phone or person in the case. I think this is sort of the crux of the objection. She continues, she's objecting to the state's submission. The phone has to be close to a tower if it's hitting off of it, the state argued. You can't be making that decision. It has to be the court's ruling. That confirming that defendant was in the car with the victim because the defendant's cell phone hits off the tower on Parvins Mill Road at the same time as the victim's car is driving by a location. So I think the objection, Justice Wehner Apler, was very much right on point to the problem. I would say that counsel objected in many other ways as well. At the 104 hearing, based on 403 grounds, counsel said that the evidence would confuse the jury and shouldn't come in because it's not relevant if it's not offered for the location of defendant's phone. So that's basically my position today, and that objection was right on point.
When counsel, I'm sorry, was objecting to the evidence, was it to the evidence or only to Lehman's description of it?
Well,
or recitation of it.
Yeah. So Your Honor, there was a stipulation as to the records coming in, but I view that as a stipulation to the authenticity of the records. So defense counsel was saying, I don't think he should come in to talk about location at all because it's not relevant. But if he does come in, he has to talk about location, but he doesn't have the expertise to do that, was the objection. So she said the records could come in, but not allowing the state to use those records in the worst possible way.
You would object, for example, to the hypothetical we were discussing with opposing counsel, where if the records were admitted because they were not objected to, then in theory, the prosecutor could have gone through the same undertaking during summation. It would have taken more time and flipping more papers. But you're saying actually, if that had been defense counsel's understanding, they would have objected to that as well, because they did fundamentally object to the phone records being relevant in any way to any point that needed to be proven.
Correct, Your Honor. And I think that you know, again, sort of highlight my example with the electropherogram. There's certain evidence that comes in that doesn't really have any relevance unless it's tethered to some expertise. It's not relevant to what you're arguing it has to be relevant to unless there's somebody who can come in and explain the discipline. So I think that's very similar.
So the state has argued there is some common understanding with respect to cell phones, not DNA, and I won't try to repeat the word that you've now given us twice that scares us all. How do you respond to that?
I think that Justice Pierre-Louis is right on point, that it's not so clear to me that people have a general understanding of how cell phones work. Even if they understand in the most general sense that cell phones work as a two-way radio, do they know that a connection area is 100 feet, 100 miles? That makes all the difference in the world. There was a time not that long ago, I thought cell phones connected to not cell towers, but satellites. I mean, that's kind of embarrassing to admit that now because it seems so obvious, but it's not common knowledge to the extent that some of the opinions suggest, and certainly not to the degree that the state has suggested in its argument.
So what's your response, counsel, to the state's argument that they were not talking about a specific location, they were talking about the travel and a series of calls that were made in the course of a period of time?
Yes, Your Honor. There are three areas where Lehman's testimony was especially problematic. The path of travel was obviously one of them. Every time he talked about one of the towers, it was always with regard to some significant event in the state's case. At 7:12, a connection went to Franklin Township, which Lehman said was, quote, in proximity to the crash site. At 7:27, it was 3,000 feet and also close proximity to the crash site. At 7:34, there was a call, quote, in proximity to Monroe Township. At 7:35, there was a call that connected to a tower southeast of the previous tower. What does that suggest? It suggests motion, based on Lehman's testimony. Now, in fact, as I explained in the brief, there might not be motion at all. It would be motion in the other direction. You can't be basing motion off of sequential towers, not at this granular level. Between 7:48 and 7:56 a.m., there were six calls, and the general pattern there was Lehman saying these were calls moving toward Bridgeton. Again, geographic significance. This was never just a fact testimony in a vacuum. At 8:07, the call connected to a water tower 1.6 miles from the victim's car as it was captured on surveillance video. So that's pretty specific distance. And then at 8:25, Lehman testified that the call connected to 110 East Commerce Street, which is a location that would service both the client's home and the scene of the crime. So that's one example, Your Honor, of problematic use of his testimony. I think.
And what could what could an expert do with that information?
An expert could have looked, okay, so ideally an expert would say, okay, this first tower, let me do a drive test or some other way, figure out the actual coverage area of that tower and sector. So I can tell the jury, we're not doing a crude pie chart. That is far too crude. If you look at a pie chart compared to a drive test, you're going to see, you know, an ink blot versus, you know, clear lines.
Test would be, and I know from prior cases where this has come up, a drive test would be actually determining at a particular location which tower is being connected to by a cell phone that the expert is using.
That's right, Your Honor. And I call that the gold standard in my brief.
I thought there was also information in your brief, I'm sorry, about how where any particular cell phone and which tower it connects to depends on weather and depends on whether one particular tower is down at a specific Absolutely. Time compared to another. So given that the drive test obviously could never take place on the day of the crime, wouldn't you always be arguing in that case, for example, that even the drive test wasn't reliable because there were varying factors that are relevant to cell towers that cannot be accounted for absolutely. After the fact?
A great argument that defense counsel would make, and that's why you need an expert. The expert would say, okay, I've taken that into account. The weather was similar. I didn't do a contemporaneous drive test, but I did take account of the fact that there were no new man-made features. The topography hasn't changed. The weather was similar. I checked all the neighboring towers and they were operational. He could recreate it to the best of his ability, and that's what an expert can do. He can give
for example, opinions. If he couldn't do that, could then just cell phone, I mean, courts across the country are admitting this evidence. Are we saying New Jersey should be unlike every other court and just say, this is just not reliable because an expert cannot possibly get the exact same conditions on the day the crime was committed, and so we're gonna keep putting up guardrails around cell phone testimony until we have created so many that it is impossible to get them into any case.
I'm not going that far, Your Honor. I'm saying that
you're not making the argument here that we need to require drive tests, right?
No, okay, not at all.
I didn't think so.
No, no. I'm just comparing what to answer a previous question as to what with what an expert could have done with that information about the connection to sequential towers.
Just to complete that thought, then, what could an expert who has appropriate qualifications actually plot everything out on a map based upon which tower was being connected with at any given time?
The idea would be the drive test. If you can't do that, he can take into account a lot of different variables and provide his expert opinion on where he believes the phone could have been, a range based on the propagation of the radio signal from the tower in that particular sector. So he could have drawn, very crudely, pie wedges. Obviously explain that limitation to the jury, that's important, but draw a series of pie wedges and perhaps could have suggested a path of travel. In my brief, I used the example of traveling from New Jersey to Oklahoma. And if you have my phone traveling and hitting a tower in Indiana on day two and Michigan on day three, and then Oklahoma on day five, well, that's such a general conclusion that it's hard to quibble with that. But we have the opposite here. This is a very granular fact that the jury is being asked to infer. And that brings me to the second part, which I think is the most problematic. Second way that layman's testimony harmed my client prejudicially and unfairly. There was a brief change in connections at the time of the killing suggested that my client had moved south. The homicide was believed to have occurred at about 8:31 a.m. At 8:07 a.m. and 9:37, sandwiching the homicide, the phone connected with a tower that serves both my client's home and the homicide scene. But Lehman testified that there was a call at 8:50 p.m. that connected to a tower south of the crime scene. And he juxtaposed that with evidence that the shooter fled south from the scene based on surveillance video and based on the path of a scent tracking dog. So the obvious implication at a very granular level was the guy who was fleeing south right after the crime scene was Mr. Hanna, because that's what his phone did. His phone flipped south at a very fine level. So we know that was him fleeing south before he went back to his home. That undercut, and the reason why, Your Honor, there can't be a harmless error analysis that defeats the claim here, that was very, very prejudicial. Even if you believed that my client was in the vehicle with Lopez, there was still good evidence that he was dropped off at Reeves Road. This was the other part of town. The state's own evidence put him at 25 or somewhere around Reeves Road, not as far as 52, but perhaps as far as 25 where my client lived. Why else was he in that part of town but to drop off my client?
Did the state argue harmless error in its briefs?
Nope, I just raised it, Your Honor, because it was raised by Justice Patterson briefly during questioning of the state.
Was there an extent to which the defense was attempting to use the late witness's testimony to establish their defense that he'd been dropped off earlier?
Yeah, I mean, she was trying to make lemonade. She had lost the objections, lost the earlier ruling, so... she's got to do the best that she can with that evidence, Your Honor. And that was to say, the state's own evidence suggests that if you want to accept the cell phone testimony, the state's own evidence suggests that my client might have been dropped off at his home, and his home is serviced by the same tower that services the crime scene.
Are you seeing a bright line rule? Testimony about cell tower location must be put out by an expert?
Not necessarily, Your Honor. If the question were, there's a cell tower that was put in my neighbor's yard and it's blocking the light to my tomato plants or something like that, right? You're just talking about a tower, its location, and that's the issue in the case. You know, I might not quibble with somebody who knew how to interpret these records, but not an expert on cell towers.
Sorry, could you say that again?
Yeah, the key here is the inference that's asked to be drawn. If an inference of a location of a cell phone connecting to that tower is what is asked to be drawn, then yes, an expert. That would be the bright line rule, but not.
That's the bright line you want. If the purpose of this evidence is to draw an inference on location, an expert is required.
That's the bright line rule I'd propose, Your Honor. Yep, and the narrow exception to that would be, we just want to know where the tower is because it encroaches on my elm tree, you know, something like that, where the location of the tower itself, independent of any inference that might be drawn from it, is the fact at issue. And you know, there's yet a third example of layman's testimony prejudicially harming my client. That's in the form of Gary Moore, eliminating him as a suspect. Gary Moore was someone who had earlier text messages with the victim, and it was suggested that they engaged in a drug transaction, possibly for PCP, before the victim went to Atlantic City. And Gary Moore's palm print was found on the victim's car. So he would have been a very good suspect. He would have been somebody who might have supported a third-party guilt defense. But Lehman testified that his cell phone was, quote, not anywhere near Bridgeton at the time of the murder. Well, what does that mean? An expert would say what that means is I look at all the towers in Bridgeton, and they're just a three-mile range, and this one was 15 miles, and it couldn't have been him, or it couldn't have been his phone anyway. But without that testimony, without that connection, what is the jury has to speculate? That anywhere near means something I must accept. It must be, you know, much less than 100 miles, must be just 100 feet, 50 feet. But whatever it is, it's dispositive proof that Gary Moore couldn't have been the shooter. So that's the third way in which layman's testimony harmed my client.
Do you think that the 20 states that have held that it is permissible for these types of phone records to come in and for someone to just explain where the tower is on the phone records were wrong?
In general, I do. In the brief, I explain how I think that these records are really quite complex, and to reach a conclusion, a confident conclusion about where our tower is based on a particular call that's relevant to the crime, you really should have an expert, at least in the records themselves. And I would say that was probably the extent of Detective Layman's expertise. He did have experience plotting these things on a map. So I don't quibble. I don't disagree with his ability to, have drawn dots on a map. But as soon as those inferences are being drawn, then there's the problem, Your Honor. And then I think an expert is needed. Some understanding of the cell towers has to be given to the jury for the jury to make any sort of reliable conclusion.
So in the other cases, I'm sorry, are you suggesting that the state wasn't trying to make any inference? They were just, they thought the map was helpful on its own without trying to, even in summation, extrapolate anything from it?
I think some of those cases were wrongly decided. Some of them, from reading the appellate decision, it's not very clear what the underlying facts were. I could imagine where you might have a clerk come in and plot points on the map, and that was okay because he understood the records well enough. And then the expert comes in and says, now here's why these are significant spots. That may have happened in some number of those cases. I don't know. A lot of those cases don't have enough detail for me to say they were necessarily wrongly decided. But if they were looking at records like the records that the state used in this case, and they came to the conclusion that expertise wasn't needed to interpret them, then they were wrongly decided. I would just note
that your position is strengthened by ambiguity in the limiting instructions, or do you not rely upon that or need that enough?
The limiting instructions were a disaster, Your Honor. They were either completely confusing, and I don't think the jury could have made any sense.
So even if we accept that, do you need that to come to the conclusion? If the limiting instructions were crystal clear, would you be making the same argument?
No. I don't think so. I think I would be making the same argument. I think that if the limiting instructions were crystal clear, they would be trying to do something that they weren't equipped to do. They would be trying to impart expertise that didn't exist in this case. So the instructions, as Your Honor pointed out, the first instruction didn't seem to make any sense if the jury was being told that they can't use this information to draw an inference as to location. The second instruction seemed to say that they could use it in conjunction with other evidence, but that was exactly what the state was offering. That's the problem here. These tower connections were only relevant because of the asserted geographic connection, but Lehman was not qualified, didn't provide enough information for the jury to reach that conclusion with an acceptable degree of reliability. And also, I would note, Your Honor, that the instructions didn't cure anything. They didn't explain the limitations of Lehman's testimony, and they didn't curtail the state's improper argument in summation.
Other questions, anyone? Anything you'd like to add, Mr. Ventura?
I suppose not, Your Honor. I just wanted to bolster the point that there was objections. And the nature of the stipulation wasn't a traditional stipulation. This after the 104 hearing, the prosecutor said, after hearing Your Honor's position, I'm going to decide to limit this testimony, and then explain how she was going to limit the testimony, because this was after a prior day of hearings where the judge said, this is where I'm inclined to go with the ruling. And the judge responded to her, Mrs. Snock, that's the prosecutor, you must be clairvoyant, because the decision he was just about to render embodied those limitations. So this wasn't a traditional stipulation where the two parties sat down and said, yes, this is great, I'm happy to have this evidence in the case. It was more like the state reading the tea leaves and anticipating where the court was going with its rulings.
So sorry, when you say stipulation in that circumstance, I actually had been wondering about this. There was no evidence that the defendant agreed to that. It was just that the state agreed to limit it in that way, and then the trial court called it a stipulation.
I think that's a fair characterization based on the exchange I just read, Your Honor, and the way it sort of unraveled. Again, I noted that she had preserved her objection, and also, I'll leave it at that, Your Honor. I'll just conclude briefly. This court should affirm the appellate division's decision vacating my client's convictions. In a case like this, testimony about the location of cell sites is only relevant where an inference is being drawn about the location of a phone, and that inference is only reliable if it is based on testimony from a qualified expert. Where my client's location was a crucial link in the state's proofs, this testimony denied him his rights to due process and a fair trial. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Nathan-Hallen, please.
And as I am getting over a cold, with the court's permission, I'll keep my mask on for argument.
No problem at all. Just try to keep your voice up if you can.
I'll do my best, Your Honor. May it please the court. As amici, I would just add a few brief points to supplement what defense counsel has articulated to the court. First, just to reiterate, the import of Detective Lehman's testimony went far beyond simply plotting tower locations on a map. Second, the fact that he lacked the expertise to explain the limitations of the inferences to be drawn from the cell tower data precluded the jury from making what this court has ably articulated reasonable inferences from the data before them. The reasonableness of the inferences the jury could make depended on information that Lehman was not equipped to give them, and in fact could not and did not give them. And finally, in the broader context of this type of testimony dependent on scientific or technical systems or expertise, allowing such testimony from a lay witness, particularly given the proliferation of the many types of digital evidence that we're seeing come into court today, risks presenting evidence to juries across the board that they are not equipped to understand, accurately interpret, or properly cabin within the limitations of the data before them. That creates a risk of a wrongful conviction, not merely resting testimony on foundations that are unsupported by science, but as in this case, and the far more common scenario, overstating or over implying the weight of evidence because no witness is present who can adequately explain its limitations. So to the first point, Lehman's testimony at every stage, as Mr. Vanjura articulated, juxtaposed the locations of the towers with the locations of Mr. Lopez's vehicle and other locations relevant to the state's case, the crash site, the drop-off site, the site of the alleged homicide. Just because he didn't necessarily explicitly argue himself that Mr. Hanna's phone must have been in Mr. Lopez's car based on the tower data does not negate that this was the state's entire use of the cell tower data at issue. Coupled with his earlier testimonies, I believe it was Justice Pierre-Louis who pointed out about Mr. Moore's phone, where he explicitly painted cell tower data as a proxy for the location of a device and by extension its user, he created an unchecked impression that the locations of the towers could pinpoint Mr. Hanna's cell phone. So in this instance, the jury got information about tower data, it got information about the location of Mr. Lopez's vehicle, and it got information about the locations of the distances between those two objects. What it did not get, and what would have been necessary for the jury to determine what inferences could be reasonable from the data before it, were information about the range of the towers, information about what other towers may have had stronger signal strength from the locations that the state pointed to as relevant to its case, such as the crash site, such as the locations Mr. Lopez's car was seen on surveillance video. And it did not get information about why, for instance, a phone might be stationary and yet connect to two different towers at slightly different times. In the absence of that information, the cell tower data was not only unhelpful to the jury, but actively prejudicial. It set the jury up to draw the exact inference that the state sought to have it draw in summation, but that was unsupported by the cell tower data itself, i.e., that Mr. Hanna's phone must have been in Mr. Lopez's car specifically. What an expert could have done, and what an expert would have done in this case, is explain the limitations of the data before the jury, explain, for instance, even if they didn't do a drive test, that at the outside, the range of a tower might be 3 miles, 5 miles, 7 miles, 10 miles, versus the 3,000 feet, or 1 mile, or 1.6 miles that Detective Lehman testified to.
Would it be a proper use of expert testimony to have the expert do a graphic or piece together a graphic in front of the jury in which the range was plotted on a sort of a moving on a map, essentially to show the different time periods and the locations of the range area, whether it's a pie or a slice of a pie or a radius or whatever the appropriate way of presenting it might be?
Sure. I think under Bernie, provided that the expert had adequate data to justify how they were drawing those ranges, that would be an appropriate use of an expert. That is, of course, contingent on the expert having the appropriate data to justify that, right? So an expert might say, this is the range of a tower, but if they're doing it as in Bernie, as a rule of thumb with no actual facts to back that up, that would be inappropriate. If an expert said, based on these tests of these towers that I've reviewed, or based on a drive test that I have conducted or have reviewed, this is the approximate range of a particular antenna on a particular cell site, and here's sort of the range through which it could vary given the environmental conditions, if there's a storm, if there's a high signal load. So here's the margin of error. I think that would be appropriate if based on the appropriate empirical data.
Can you explain what a drive test is, please?
Sure. So cell towers work through radio frequency signals. And a drive test is when someone who is trying to ascertain the range of a particular tower or a particular antenna on a tower travels with a radio frequency device, whether that's a phone or what have you, and measures at what point is the radio frequency transmitter still able to access and connect to that tower. And so by kind of systematically traveling a route that the tower can and can't access, you can ascertain, at least at that point in time, the rough boundaries of the tower's coverage area.
But of course, if you're trying to, if you're talking about multiple towers and someone just being in a general area, presumably a drive test for even one tower takes a very long time, right?
Depending on the tower's range, it can.
Okay, so if you wanted to talk about general area or movement of a phone and which towers it's pinging, that could take a very long time to drive test all of the different towers, correct?
Potentially. But I'm not arguing, and I don't think defense is arguing here, that a drive test would have been mandatory before this evidence could have been admitted or presented. There are other methods by which an expert can estimate or data taken from the provider that allows an expert to estimate the rough range of a given tower or a given antenna, as well as the range of fluctuation by which that is likely to vary over a given period of time. So a drive test would be one and probably the most robust way to make that determination. It's not the only way.
If the expert is reliant on evidence about from the provider, that's got to be accomplished through subpoenas, correct?
Presumably, yes. In this instance, my understanding is that Detective Lehman himself had contacts at Sprint and Verizon that he spoke with and had previously spoken with to get the training he had in reading call detail records.
But in general, communications companies don't give that up without a subpoena. Is that fair to say?
I think that would be fair to say. There's nothing to stop the state from having issued one in this case.
And there may be a need to somehow have those records explained.
Right.
So it's a complicated process.
It's a complicated process that, well, it is certainly a more complicated process than Detective Lehman went through in this case. But if the requirement is that the evidence before the jury be presented in such a way that the jury actually be able to understand it and understand what inferences can and cannot reasonably be drawn from it, then that is what is required. The fact that it takes a bit more effort than was expended in this case doesn't preclude the proponent of such evidence from having to do that. What this ultimately and fundamentally comes down to, I think, is the truth-seeking function of trial procedures, right? If a jury is presented with evidence and not given the context to make meaningful sense of it, that evidence risks prejudicing or confusing the issues. And I think in this case, the evidence did that regardless. The limiting instruction or the various iterations of the limiting instructions, as the justice pointed out, didn't help matters. But I don't think a limiting instruction in this instance could have cured the fact that the testimony itself, the evidence itself, and the state's use of it in summation went well beyond what the cell tower data itself could support. And that brings me to my second point, Your Honors. So much evidence now comes in the form of complicated digital records, whether that be cell phone records, GPS data, facial recognition readouts, electropherograms in the DNA context. We would not simply put someone who can read but not explain those records on the stand and call it a day. But that's essentially what the state did here with Detective Lehman's testimony. New Jersey has long recognized that juries are entitled and that due process requires that evidence that carries some degree of scientific or technical complexity be presented in such a way that sense can actually be made of it. We see that in this court's reasoning in Chun, requiring not just that the operator of the ALCO test be present to testify, but previously requiring through the special master's proceedings prior to that, that the source code be made available for review and that documentation of the calibration of the machine be provided. What the court recognized in Chun was essentially that cross-examination can, in most circumstances, be one way to probe the reliability, the veracity, and the value of evidence. But there are circumstances where it's not sufficient. And in that case, the court system has an obligation to make what is necessary to make those determinations available to counsel or presented to the jury. This is a situation where cross-examination would not have been adequate to explain the actual limitations or the actual inferences that could be drawn from the cell tower data without an expert who was well-versed enough in how cellular networks work to explain them. The appellate division followed this reasoning in Pickett, ordering source code disclosure for probabilistic genotyping systems. And while cellular networks are arguably a simpler system to understand than a probabilistic genotyping program, the underlying principle is that juries are entitled to the degree of background and context that would enable them to actually draw sort of reasonable inferences from the data, as opposed to overblown inferences that go unchecked in cross-examination or otherwise. And finally, I would just point out, standing here on behalf of the Innocence Project, that this is the kind of scenario that can lead to wrongful convictions. Faulty or misleading forensic science has been implicated in 29% of the known exonerations documented by the National Registry of Exonerations, in nearly 50% of the DNA exonerations litigated by the Innocence Project. And when I say faulty or misleading forensic science, that is not limited to, or even predominantly, cases where the entire underlying discipline lacks scientific validity, though that is a substantial portion of those cases. Far more common is a witness overstating the weight or the import of the scientific or technical data before the finder of fact. So cases where, for instance, you have a latent fingerprint comparison where the analyst states that only the defendant's fingerprint could have produced this latent print, when in fact the latent print was partial or smudged or could have matched to any number of different people.
Is there data as well for the use of cell phone information and location information?
Data in what sense, Your Honor?
You began this point by pointing out correct percentage of cases that have this faulty evidence.
Not to my knowledge. I don't, as far as I know, no one has done a concrete study tracking the prevalence of cell phone data in wrongful convictions.
And we accept the general point that you're making, and I'd ask if you could try to wrap up your argument.
I would just caveat on that front though, Your Honor. Cell phone evidence not being physical evidence likely would not lend itself to a DNA exoneration. And so to the extent that it may have produced wrongful convictions, we would be less likely to know. But to conclude, the evidence before the jury here was not sufficiently explained, not sufficiently limited, not sufficiently cabined, because Detective Lehman was not qualified to do any of those. And in that regard, it ran the risk of prejudicing the jury, confusing the issues, and denying Mr. Hanna due process or the opportunity to present a full and fair defense. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Tian.
Thank you, Your Honors. To address a question earlier, both parties agreed to this testimony. It's DA-6 in defendant's original appellate record. It's also 14T14. It's both the state and defense agreed to Lehman's testimony.
That Sorry, can you say one more time? DA-6.
DA-6 and I have 14, but that's not right. It's 6. I'm sorry. 6T14.
Okay.
6. And that was after the hearing in which the judge indicated he was most likely going to limit the testimony.
It was after the original motion, but before the judge ruled, the state actually said, I'm not going to introduce him as an expert. Don't even worry about it. We have agreed to limit this testimony. And then the judge said, like, that's what I was going to do anyway. So it was because the parties had already agreed. And also,
your adversary says that when we say the parties agreed, it was only because, that there was no agreement that this evidence, that the underlying records themselves could come in. It was only that they were actually records from the phone company. Do you have more information about that?
I mean, the language of the consent agreement itself doesn't say that. It says specifically, the parties stipulate that the witness, Detective Kenneth Lehman, shall be permitted to provide only lay witness testimony regarding his review, interpretation, and plotting of the location of cell towers on a map from the defendant's historical cell site data records. So from those stipulated records, here's what Lehman can use it for. And then to Justice Hoffman's questions about the instructions, defense agreed to that instruction as well. So the state was led down this path. First, they agreed to Lehman's testimony. Here, they also then agreed to how Lehman's testimony should be limited and how the jury should be instructed to use it. Now, none of those things are sufficient. Lehman's testimony went beyond it. The instruction was insufficient. Both parties agreed that this was the path to be taken, and now it's insufficient. And that's not entirely fair. To one of the points that defense counsel—
You're not arguing plain error, correct?
I'm sorry, what was that?
You were not arguing plain error, correct?
No, because they preserved their appeal issue below. To the point that defendant was prejudiced because Lehman was trying to show the tower locations meant movement, and he referenced an 850 phone call. That phone call was only brought up in cross-examination. On direct examination, the state ended at the 825 call. And then the remaining calls after that, defense counsel actually said, actually, these 16 calls that we have here, they all connected to Tower 37, didn't they? And he said, except for the end of one of them connected to Tower 304. And she said, okay, but besides that, they all connected to 37. So it was only on cross-examination that tower movement testimony was even elicited at all. So it certainly wasn't the state's intention to try to show movement with that testimony. To the point that these records don't make sense without an expert. I'm not an expert, I don't claim to be, but I was able to pull the coordinates from the records, put them into some website I found about coordinates, and make my own map. The jury wouldn't have had access to that website, certainly, but you can cross-reference these records. It doesn't take a cell phone expert to determine the information you need from these records. It's a bit time-consuming and a little tedious, but you can do it.
But you don't know the range from the records, correct?
Correct. And that's why the state wasn't necessarily relying on the range. Tower 37, the one that was at the scene of the homicide, made no difference. It connected to the defendant's house. It connected to the homicide scene. We weren't saying that that location meant anything, but please follow this pattern of connections. And that's why the vicinity of the connection to this tower makes a difference as opposed to the precise location of the cell phone. So unless your justices have any other questions, those were my only points in rebuttal.
Thank you. Thank you to all counsel. We'll take the matter under advisement.